Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, pictures of apparently brutalized U.S. soldiers in northern Iraq and the shadow of Somalia 10 years ago.
Candidate Wesley Clark. He says President Bush pulled a bait and switch when America invaded Iraq.
He promised us Osama bin Laden dead or alive. Instead, he diverted public attention, resources, intelligence, special operations to attack Iraq.
Also, the federal government turns its attention to autism.
One would know that he is a little odd. They might, upon meeting him, get the impression that he's very bright, which he is, but there's something really odd and quirky about him.
And the Beatles, naked.
These stories and more coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A jury in Virginia is recommending that sniper John Allen Muhammad be sentenced to death for one of the Washington, D.C. area killings and for terrorizing that region last fall. The jurors concluded that prosecutors had proved at least one of the aggravating factors that would allow the death penalty, that Muhammad would pose a danger in the future, or that his crimes were wantonly vile. NPR's Brian Naylor says the atmosphere in the courtroom was emotionally subdued as the decision was read.
There was no audible or visual reaction from any of the family members present. They were admonished by Judge Leroy Millett before the verdicts were read that they should contain themselves, and apparently they did. Muhammad himself stood up straight. He looked straight ahead as the clerk read the sentencing recommendations. He displayed absolutely no emotion, just as he hasn't displayed any emotion throughout this entire trial.
NPR's Brian Naylor in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Prosecutor Paul Ebert said the jurors made the right decision about Muhammad.
One thing's for sure, they took pleasure in terrorizing people. They took pleasure in killing people, and that's the kind of man that doesn't deserve to be in society.
Muhammad will be formally sentenced in February. Judge Leroy Millett could reduce the punishment to life in prison, but judges in Virginia rarely take such a step. At the trial of Muhammad's alleged accomplice, Lee Boyd Malvo, prosecutors are presenting more tape recordings of interviews Malvo had with police investigators. In the tapes already played, Malvo is heard bragging about his shooting ability and laughing as he describes how some of the victims were hit. President Bush has signed a $401 billion defense spending bill into law. In a ceremony at the Pentagon, Mr. Bush praised the military.
Right now, America's armed forces are the best trained, best equipped, and best prepared in the world, and this administration will keep it that way.
The spending measure gives U.S. military personnel an average 4% raise. Israel has expelled three Palestinian militants from the West Bank to the Gaza Strip without charges or trial. Israeli human rights groups are complaining about the move, as NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Israeli military sources said the three militants, all in their 20s, were taken from the West Bank to the fenced-off Gaza Strip. Israel barred all three men from returning to the West Bank for 2 years. Another 13 West Bank Palestinians are slated for expulsion to Gaza for alleged complicity in armed attacks. Two Palestinians were deported earlier this month. Israel says the move does not violate international law because it is moving Palestinians from one part of the occupied territories, the West Bank, to another part, Gaza. But Israeli human rights groups say expulsion violates the Geneva Convention, and Palestinian officials describe it as a crime. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Wall Street, the Dow is up 105 points. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, stocks have been holding on to gains so far today. Analysts cite a rebound in the value of the dollar against other currencies today. Economic reports due out this week should provide an update on the pace of the economic recovery, but no major market moves are anticipated in this shortened trading week. Delta Airlines has announced that its chief executive officer is resigning. Susanna Cupp-Capilluto of Georgia Public Radio has more.
Delta Chairman and CEO Leo Mullen has decided to retire on May 1st. The Atlanta-based airline says Mullen will step down as CEO on January 1st and will remain chairman until Delta's annual meeting of shareholders in April. Mullen's decision follows discussions he initiated with the board of directors earlier this year regarding his desire to retire. He will be replaced by Gerald Grinstein and John Smith. Grinstein has been a director with Delta for 16 years. He'll become CEO effective January 1st. Smith once served as CEO of General Motors. He will become Delta's non-executive chairman in May. Mullins, who joined Delta in 1997, will have a total retirement benefit valued at $16 million. For NPR News, I'm Susanna Capoluto in Atlanta.
Aerospace giant Boeing has fired its chief financial officer and another executive for unethical conduct involving a plan to have the Air Force lease Boeing planes for use as refueling tankers. The Pentagon launched a probe this fall into allegations that a former Air Force official gave Boeing information about a competing bid for the service. That official was eventually hired by the CFO. Both have now been fired. Checking Wall Street, the Dow is up 105 at 97.33, and the Nasdaq has gained 33 at 19.27. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, saluting America's families this Thanksgiving during National Family Week. On the web at aecf.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Over the weekend, two American soldiers were shot while traveling in a jeep in northern Iraq. They were then mutilated by an angry mob of mostly teenagers, according to reports. It's been widely reported that their throats may have been cut. In Afghanistan, a Black Hawk helicopter crashed, killing five American soldiers, wounding seven more. The cause of the crash has not been announced, though there are reports a rocket may have brought the helicopter down. Well, joining us on the line from the Pentagon is Vince Crawley, defense reporter for the Army Times. And Vince, how has the Pentagon reacted to the brutalizing of these soldiers?
They did send a staff officer around this morning to emphasize that, from what they can tell, the troops did not have their throats cut. Mm-hmm. They said that the soldiers were shot through the windshield and apparently died from those gunshot wounds and then were pulled from the vehicles. They were trying very hard to emphasize that they didn't believe these people had been mauled either before or after death.
Really? So what do you make of these reports, Vince? And what about the photographic evidence that the bodies were on the street and seemingly had been mauled?
The photographs speak for themselves. Although I haven't seen any close-up photographs, just in my cursory looking on the wires. But definitely folks who had been pulled from their vehicles and not well-treated, but of course being shot in the head isn't being well-treated either.
Close-up photographs are actually hard to find. They have not been widely disseminated in newspapers.
Yes, which is surprising to me this morning when I woke up and saw just the tiniest couple of lines on the front page of the Post. I think a part of it is that people wanted to see how this developed before jumping to too many conclusions. On the surface, it looks a lot like what happened just over 10 years ago in Mogadishu. And certainly the first reports, of a soldier being pulled through the streets after being killed in a helicopter, after being killed in that firefight.
So, Vince, are you suggesting that maybe newspapers declined to show closer-up photographs because it might be seen as incendiary in some way?
Yeah, I mean, that's up to each newspaper has its own policy. So I can't speak for the newsrooms. There is a great deal of reticence on showing American dead. The military, of course, is extremely squeamish about this, or at least the military leaders, if you talk to the actual troops fighting sometimes there.
Yeah.
Because it's a reality to them, they are sometimes less sensitive to it. In fact, our papers created some ire in the chain of command by showing a mortally wounded person before he had died.
Mm. Mosul, where this happened, Vince, has been a relatively peaceful place in Iraq. In fact, the U.S. military has been credited with some real progress there on schools and hospitals and winning over the population. There has been a crackdown there, though, in recent days. Is there any discussion around the Pentagon that the crackdown could have led to the seeming fury of this mob?
Certainly. And when you talk to the staffers who are in communication with the people in the field, they say they're definitely trying to do a fine balance, which is very difficult when you're shooting bullets at people on either side, to not alienate the greater civilian population when you're targeting just a few people in a few neighborhoods. And certainly that's what they're facing at the larger scale crackdown in Baghdad.
Vince, what's the latest word on the helicopter, the Black Hawk, that went down near Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan? There is some reporting out there that some witnesses allegedly saw a rocket.
I was told just a few minutes ago that because it was a helicopter associated with special operations, that we're probably not going to get anything too specific from Washington right away. Mm-hmm. They did tell me was there were 15 people on board, 5 killed, 7 injured. The helicopter had just taken off from Bagram and was ferrying people to the military operation taking place near the Pakistan border, where the Al-Qaeda and Taliban have been reportedly regrouping and trying to come across. And that could be another reason why it might be difficult to get too much information. If, in fact, rocket fire took place, the military would not be too excited to let people know that there was this additional vulnerability.
Vince Crawley is defense reporter for the Army Times. He spoke to us from his office in Washington, D.C. Thanks a lot, Vince.
No problem.
Less than 24 hours after rising to the seat of power, the interim president of the former Soviet Republic of Georgia has given her first speech to the nation, vowing to hold elections within the next 45 days. Police and security forces continue to restore order today after thousands of protesters convinced longtime President Edward Shevardnadze to resign yesterday. David Filipov has been covering events in Georgia for the Boston Globe. He joins us from Moscow. Hello, David.
Hey.
And start by telling us a little bit about what happened leading up to this weekend ouster, which was pretty dramatic. Was it watched on television sets in Moscow?
Oh, yeah. Everyone was watching this. The protest had been growing for 3 weeks since an election that most of the opposition parties disputed. It became big news here when the opposition parties stormed into the parliament when Shevardnadze was giving a speech on Saturday.
And what happened? Shevardnadze has governed Georgia for at least 12 years. He was a popular president at the start. What happened?
Well, he came in with the credentials that I'm sure some listeners will remember. He was one of the forces behind the whole democratization of the Soviet Union. He did turn Georgia towards more Western policy, but he wasn't able to follow through on improving the country's economy and getting rid of corruption. And as time went on, people felt like Shevardnadze was more about protecting Shevardnadze in power and less about worrying about the needs of Georgians.
Is it thought that Shevardnadze himself rigged the November elections?
Well, either he gave the orders or his administration did it with his knowledge. What's remarkable about Georgia is that people in Georgia were able to go out in the streets and protest it, and that the authorities didn't do anything to stop them.
And obviously others are watching this not just to see whether or not Georgia will become more destabilized, which worries many because of neighboring Chechnya, but to see if this sort of democratic movement, which we seem to see over the weekend, takes root in other countries.
Well, it will be very difficult for other former Soviet countries to see the same kind of popular uprising as there has been in Georgia. Shevardnadze did allow a far more liberal society than you get in many of the former Soviet states. And the image of people, hundreds, tens of thousands of people going out into the street and nobody doing anything about it, nobody sending in tanks, that's something that has to be shocking to some of the former Soviet leaders who are entrenched and who run things with a firmer hand. We won't know exactly who is going to be the leader of Georgia until presidential elections are held in a month and a half, whether or not those new leaders will help stabilize the country or not. It depends a lot on the way that the separatist leaders of several of Georgia's breakaway provinces accept the new leaders. So far, two of these separatist regions haven't recognized the opposition government. And if there's any tension in the coming weeks, it will be in those areas.
David, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
David Filipov has been covering events in Georgia for the Boston Globe. He spoke to us from Moscow.
The number of children diagnosed with autism in the United States is rising at an unprecedented rate. 10 years ago, fewer than 20,000 were considered autistic. Now, 120,000 are. No one's sure how to explain the surge, though it has led now to the federal government's first attempt to map out a strategy to confront autism and the related disorder, Asperger syndrome. Joining us on the line now is Dr. Fred Volkmar of the Child Study Center at Yale University. Welcome, Dr. Volkmar.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. We're also joined by Lori Sherry, president of the Asperger Syndrome Education Network and the parent of a teenager with Asperger syndrome in Edison, New Jersey. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Bill.
Well, doctor, first, can you briefly define autism and Asperger syndrome for us?
These disorders were actually described first around, 1944. The man who described autism in this country was a man named Leo Kanner, who talked about children who came into the world without the kind of predisposition to make social contact. A year later, working in Austria, a man, Asperger, talked about a similar condition. However, in contrast to autism, where children often have major problems with language and communication, the children that Asperger described have major problems in social interaction, but they're quite verbal.
Well, doctor, before we talk to Lori about her personal experience of this, you helped write a new federal approach to the problem. Can you outline it for us?
Sure. So it's really a plan to look at areas that are either safer or a little more risky in terms of investing our resources, in terms of research dollars, over the next decade.
Lori, tell us about your teenager.
My son Adam will be 17 in another 2 weeks, and he was originally diagnosed with attention deficit disorder when he was around 5, because a lot of the symptoms of autism spectrum disorders tend to mimic those of attentional deficit disorders. He was then diagnosed with Asperger syndrome at age 9.5. He is a junior in high school, and we are looking at colleges at the moment. He's always been in the mainstream, and he does very well academically, but of course his difficulties were more socially related. But with intervention, he's got social skills training and occupational therapy, and he has an individualized education plan, also known as an IEP, in school. He's been able to do very well.
Would one know, meeting Adam, that he had this Asperger syndrome?
One would know that he is a little odd. Mm-hmm. They might, upon meeting him, get the impression that he's very bright, which he is, but there's something really odd and quirky about him.
Doctor, these new federal guidelines, what impact might they have on a boy like Adam?
Well, at the moment, the guidelines really include a range of options for research, everything from looking for genes and brain mechanisms to the level of intervention. And my guess is it's actually at the level of intervention that children and adolescents like Adam will first see some of the differences.
Doctor, is it being discussed at all the possibility of a child no longer being autistic? Can that ever happen?
There is some hope and indeed some expectation that with early and intensive intervention, there can be some children, and I emphasize some, who will essentially function quite normally in the mainstream setting in schools without need for additional supports. And I think that's a very reasonable goal. I always want to be a little careful when I talk about cures, but I think we really are talking about a major, major improvement in long-term outcome.
Lori, did you always expect that your son would go to college, or is this something that's evolved? And what are your hopes now for the sort of life he will lead?
When Adam was little, and before we knew he even had a disability, we thought we had this brilliantly gifted child, and of course he was going to Harvard or Yale or Princeton. We just weren't sure which one. Mm-hmm. As he developed and we realized he had difficulties and we got the diagnosis, our expectations became more realistic, I guess. At this point, I would say, yes, we do expect him to go to college. We do expect him to be able to support himself and live on his own. Whether the same dreams and same outcomes would hold true that we had 17 years ago, probably not. But we have our hopes for him, and we think that he has a good future.
Well, Lori Sherry, it's been so good of you to share a few moments with us. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Lori Sherry is president of the Asperger Syndrome Education Network. And Dr. Fred Volkmar, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Fred Volkmar joined us on the line from Yale University.
Just ahead, candidate for president Wesley Clark.
And later in the show, could it be an all-nighter as the U.S. Senate debates Medicare reform?
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
A new Time Magazine CNN poll indicates that if the presidential election were held today, President Bush would win by a narrow margin. But the Democrat who would give him the toughest fight, retired Army General Wesley Clark. The Vietnam veteran, former NATO chief in Kosovo, businessman and CNN commentator, entered the fray only last September. We checked in with General Clark by cell phone earlier today as he traveled to tonight's Iowa debate. We began by asking him about comments from retired General Hugh Shelton, former chief of staff, who said he wouldn't vote for Clark and that Clark left his position in Kosovo as NATO chief because of issues of character and integrity. Clark has said this was a policy dispute, one that turned personal, and he has his supporters on Kosovo. But we asked, with high-ranking enemies in the Pentagon, why should the American public trust him with the explosive issue of Iraq?
We saved 1.5 million Albanians, and Slobodan Milosevic is in The Hague. There were many people who had parts of that policy, but I certainly did my duty, and I did it against the wishes of some in the Pentagon. So I think the results speak for themselves, and that's why the American people trust me.
Well, General Clark, as president, would you tolerate a commander who differed with the opinion of defense and Pentagon?
Of course, I would expect a commander to have strong views. I don't want some commander who's not going to tell us what he thinks because he's afraid to disagree with the Secretary of Defense. That's the worst kind of military you could ever have. It's a military in which you can go the wrong direction because the officers below are intimidated from expressing their professional judgments.
Well, how would you, as president, respond to what's happening today, the increasing body count of American soldiers in Iraq?
I think we need a success strategy in Iraq. This administration hasn't had one and still doesn't. I would go to the local councils that have already been democratically elected and ask each council to send two representatives to form a central government in Baghdad. It's indirect democracy. It's the way we used to elect senators in this country. And we'd put them immediately in charge of things like oil and oil revenues and how to use funds for reconstruction. And we'd be pulling the country together. It's important that we do this politically now.
Looking to future conflicts, would you repeal the Bush administration policy of preemptive war?
I would. That would be one of the first documents that I would put in the shredder when I become president.
But as you know, there's a perception that your position and other positions of the Democratic candidates make them soft on terrorism. And some would say that it's a position that the Republican Party is exploiting. I want to turn for a second to an ad that the Republican Party began running yesterday. It seems to mock any call for retreat, any kind of retreat, in the war on terror. Let's give a listen to what the president says in the Republican-run ad.
Some have said we must not act until the threat is imminent. Since when have terrorists and tyrants announced their intentions, politely putting us on notice before they strike?
Over the president's spoken words are imposed the written words. Some are now attacking the president for attacking the terrorists. Your response to the ad?
Robin, I'm not attacking the president for attacking the terrorists. I'm attacking the president because he's not attacking the terrorists. He has pulled the largest bait-and-switch operation in American history. He promised us Osama bin Laden dead or alive. Instead, he diverted public attention, resources, intelligence, special operations, the United States Armed Forces, and $150 billion to attack Iraq, which, as we've seen, has very little to do with the war on terrorism, and now we're in a mess. That's why I'm attacking the president.
Well, General Clark, I want to turn to some domestic issues. The death penalty. You said at the Women's Issue Forum in New Hampshire that you were for the death penalty. As you remember, that comment was met with silence. is this a risky tact for a Democratic candidate to take?
I believe that this country and the states have the right to seek the ultimate sanction. I also said I don't like the way the death penalty has been applied. I think it has been applied historically in a discriminatory fashion, and we should be using modern technology to go back and reopen a bunch of cases of people who are still on death row in various states. That having been said, though, I believe that this country and the states in this country have the right, if they choose, if the voters in the state choose, to retain the death penalty.
Turn to Medicare. Currently, the reform of Medicare is being debated in the Senate. The Republicans say they're going to win on this and that they'll campaign next year on having saved Medicare and providing drugs for seniors. Why aren't they right? What will be your response to that if, in fact, they do win?
My response to it is that they put a poison pill inside Medicare that will ultimately destroy the system. It'll remove the financing, the support for Medicare, and will put Medicare in competition with profit-driven HMOs, which will simply raise their rates and reduce coverage, ultimately, for seniors, ending one of the greatest programs we've had in American history to take care of senior citizens. Mm.
Your response, though, is what the Republicans say is going to make this a losing match for the Democrats because it's far more complicated than what the Republicans are saying, which is we're providing drugs for seniors.
Well, the way I feel about politics is I trust the American public, and the public's pretty smart about things. And I think that they know that simplicity is not always the right answer. There are a lot of simple answers in life, and a lot of them are wrong. And in this case, both the Republicans' answer on the war on terror, attack Iraq, and the answer on Medicare, just put money in and feed the HMOs, both are simple and both are wrong.
Moving to the schools, the next president's going to inherit at least a $400 billion deficit. The states are bleeding, can't pay for things like education. Would you use the office of president as sort of a bully pulpit to encourage states to raise taxes so that kids don't have to further pay down the road?
The terrible truth is that states are already raising taxes, and so are localities, as a result of the Bush tax cuts. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to Americans and ask the wealthiest Americans, those making $200,000 a year and above, to give back the tax cuts that President Bush gave out there. He took about $1 trillion away from our ability to deal with America's most pressing problems. Because it's in America's interest to have the best public education system in the world, and it's in America's interest as the wealthiest country in the world to ensure that every child in America has health insurance and that health insurance is universally accessible for all Americans.
General Clark, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
General Wesley Clark, Democratic candidate for president, spoke to us on his way to the debate tonight.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we continue our conversation with presidential candidates when we meet Senator John Edwards of North Carolina.
There's more ahead, Here and Now. We'll be right back.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, more on reports of an enraged mob of Iraqis mutilating the bodies of two dead U.S. soldiers.
It does sound like Shades of Mogadishu, and as you mentioned, those pictures really led to a change in U.S. policy.
And Beatles guru Tim Riley is the newly released Let It Be Naked, More with Less.
I find there's something irresistible about Lennon goofing up his own words. And when they smooth that over and then try and sell it to us as something that's naked and unkempt, that's where I take objection.
These stories and more coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. After deliberating for 5 hours over 2 days, a jury in Virginia has recommended a death sentence for convicted sniper John Muhammad. More from correspondent Thelma LeBrecq.
On both capital murder charges, the jury found Muhammad should be sentenced to death, agreeing with the prosecution that the crimes were outrageously vile and that he presented a continuing serious threat to society. Afterwards, the judge thanked the jurors for their involvement and commitment, saying their dedication and dignity demonstrates why the U.S. system of justice is the best in the world, no matter how terrible the crime.
That report from Thelma LeBrecht. The Pentagon announced today that it has released 20 more prisoners from its high-security detention camp for suspected terrorists at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, because they no longer posed a threat to U.S. security or no longer required detention. At the same time, it brought in 20 new suspects from an undisclosed location, maintaining the inmate population at the camp at 660. Officials did not identify those released nor their countries. President Bush signed a $400 billion defense authorization bill this morning. Among other items, the legislation raises salaries for soldiers by an average of 4% and extends increases in combat and family separation pay.
Those who risk their lives for our liberty deserve to be fairly paid and fairly treated, and this bill keeps those commitments.
Following the Pentagon signing ceremony, the president left town for a holiday week at his ranch in Crawford, Texas. One of the Middle East's biggest television news networks today agreed to stop broadcasting reports from Iraq after the U.S.-appointed government raided its office, banned its broadcast, and threatened to imprison journalists. The Iraqi Governing Council accused Al Arabiya of inciting murder by broadcasting an audio tape a week ago of a voice it said belonged to Saddam Hussein. The network says it will continue to report on Iraq from its headquarters in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. Big changes for cell phone users today. New federal guidelines taking effect mean that cell phone users no longer have to change their phone numbers every time they change their carriers. Also starting today, consumers can move their home landline telephone numbers to their cell phones. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are higher. The Dow is up 96 points at 97.25. The Nasdaq is up 33 points. The S&P 500 is up 12.
Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
I imagine we're all looking forward to Thanksgiving later this week. Well, Congress is too. Members want to get out of Washington and go home. Standing in the way, that massive Medicare reform bill meant to help seniors pay for their prescription drugs. Well, to explore the state of play on that bill as the hours now tick away, and for a glimpse of an unrelated but intriguing new poll, we're joined now by members of our D.C. Roundtable. Andrea Stone is congressional correspondent for USA Today. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Bill.
And Bill Douglas is White House correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Andrea, starting with you, so the Medicare bill passed the House this weekend. Before we get to the horse race in the Senate, whether the bill will pass or not, I keep hearing the disagreement here boils down to whether or not to privatize Medicare. But what does that mean?
Well, privatize is a word that the Democrats would use, and the Republicans would call it having competition and cost control. It's just a absolute ideological divide here. Republicans want to see the private sector more involved, and Democrats are suspicious of the private sector and say, you know, traditional Medicare's work just fine. Let's, you know, not break it.
So does it boil down to whether the government will be able to buy prescription drugs in bulk using the government's huge market clout to keep prices low?
Interestingly, no. One of the things that the Republicans made sure was in the bill that was that the government could not negotiate the price of prescription drugs. That would be left to HMOs and to private plans. And it's the privatization, as the Democrats call it, that they say will dismantle Medicare as we've known it for the last 38 years.
Because it would all be in the hands of insurance companies and drug companies as to how much people pay for drugs?
Well, you know, up till now, everybody's paid the same premiums for their coverage for Medicare. Under this plan, there would be differences across regions. Some economists think that the private plans would siphon off the healthier and younger elderly and leave the sickest and oldest for Medicare to take care of.
I see the private companies wouldn't take someone who was already ill.
Right. In the past, that has been the case, that they tend to want the healthier senior citizens because obviously that costs them less to treat them.
Hmm. So what's the chance of passage in the Senate before Turkey Day?
Well, we're all hoping we'll get out of here before Turkey Day. I think this afternoon they're going to try to close off debate and get to a vote, but the Democrats are going to try and stall that. It's not clear that the Democrats can stave it off for long, and either tonight or maybe into tomorrow we'll see an up or down vote on this.
I see. Bill, how important is this vote to President Bush?
Oh, it's very important to President Bush. It would give him another notch in the reelection belt, saying he got something accomplished that he can take out on the road and campaign on.
A new Time magazine poll, Bill, indicates that were the election held today, 47% of the electorate would be strongly for President Bush, 48% would be strongly against him. A very divided electorate, and that seems to leave a very small sliver of people who are kind of undecided that may determine who gets elected.
The sliver of the undecideds, it's a very small window. And the interesting thing is, if you look back to where we were after it was finally decided that Bush won the election, we haven't moved that much. We're almost right back where we started with a very divided electorate. Mm. Bush has worked very hard to try to change that. He's tried in some areas to show a somewhat moderate hand, not in all areas, but you still have a very, very divided electorate.
Andrea, your thoughts on the 5% that will, according to this Time magazine poll, possibly decide the next election?
I think, you know, that's one of the reasons that some Democrats are really worried about Howard Dean. Democrats say we've got to have somebody who can get to that middle, to that swing voter. One of the things that the Democrats are really concerned about is the South. You know, Al Gore didn't win his own state, and he lost the election. And the conventional wisdom is that, you know, Democrats have to pick up something in the South to win. But there are a lot fewer swing voters in those southern states. And some analysts are even saying that, hey, why don't we look to the Southwest, to places like New Mexico and Nevada, which are in recent years becoming more Democratic, and maybe those can make up for the weakness of the Democrats in the South.
Bill, what about the president today in Colorado, Fort Carson, Colorado? 27 soldiers from that base have died in Iraq. Will he be publicly acknowledging that? Will he be publicly consoling families, as he's been criticized for not doing publicly?
He'll be privately consoling families, but publicly we'll make some comments or some statements acknowledging the deaths in Iraq. This is something that's become a little bit of a problem for the president. He's questioned a lot about the fact that he has not said that much about U.S. casualties. You've got a situation where the media is a bit upset at the White House and the federal government because they're not allowed to to film arrival ceremonies of dead soldiers. That's been X'd out.
Yeah, and Andrea, we noted in our newspapers this weekend two soldiers brutally killed in northern Iraq. Well, they were shot, and then a mob of teenagers attacked them. It was very difficult to find photographs of that terrible event. Matt Drudge, the internet guy, put a picture on his website and was criticized for it. The pictures have been hard to find, unlike, I think, of Somalia, when the Black Hawk helicopter crashed and soldiers were dragged through the streets. We saw those images again and again, and the U.S. ended up pulling out of Somalia. What's going on?
I think the Pentagon is very sensitive to getting the right message out. I think the decision in Baghdad yesterday to not release any details on this particular incident, which was so much different than some of the others that we've seen. I mean, there were reports that teenagers came out with cinder blocks and slammed the bodies after they were dead. It does sound like shades of Mogadishu, and as you mentioned, you know, those pictures really led to a change in U.S. policy to get our soldiers out of there. I mean, this administration doesn't want something like that to happen.
But, Andrea, are editors making a decision not to show the photographs?
Well, I mean, if you can't get near it, you can't show it. And I think that the editors do have to use their, use their judgment, their discretion, mm-hmm. right. But, you know, I think there's a larger issue here. And, you know, journalists have filed formal complaints about how they're being kept away from the news in Iraq. Photographers in Iraq have had their cameras confiscated. There is a real, it's really hard to get information out of the coalition authority that Paul Bremer is in charge of. Even back in July when I was in Baghdad, I had to literally go banging on the gates of the presidential palace to see anybody. Nobody returned my calls. So they really are trying to control the message.
We have a sort of an interesting flip here. If you remember a couple of months ago, the U.S. government released the pictures of the Hussein brothers.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
Because they had to prove to the Iraqis that the Husseins were indeed dead. But it was a conscious decision they made after some deliberation. So in that regard, some gruesome pictures served their purposes.
Right.
Bill Douglas is White House correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Thanks a lot, Bill.
Thank you.
Andrea Stone is congressional correspondent for USA Today. Thanks, Andrea.
Thank you, Bill.
Still to come, should they have Let It Be? Our review of the new Naked Beatles classic.
You're listening to Here and Now. Tom Edson leads a double life. He's Executive Vice President for Corporate Affairs at Fidelity Investments here in Boston. But his imagination roams the American West, circa about 100 years ago. You see, Tom Edson writes westerns, one of which, The Last Ride, has now been made into a film called The Missing. Directed by Ron Howard and starring Cate Blanchett and Tommy Lee Jones, The Missing opens nationwide on November 26th. Tom Edson joins us in the studio now. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Tom, why westerns?
You know, I think it's in my genetic structure. I come from a long line of farmers and cattle ranchers and Indian agents.
But your dad was a CPA who left the Midwest, right, to go to L.A., and you grew up in L.A., then you worked in New York, then Boston.
Absolutely. My father said he started out as a wheat farmer, and he said he had two loves in life. One was accounting, one was wheat farming, and he said he was going to do them both.
You were at Hill & Knowlton. In fact, you ran the place, right?
I did. I was the worldwide CEO in the early 90s.
That was in New York. Then Fidelity Investments here in Boston. When the heck do you find time to knock off a novel every once in a while?
Well, it's an early morning routine, and it's my form of golf on the weekend. So I'm up usually by 4:30 or 5 in the morning, work a couple hours, edit at night, and then on the weekends I put in two pretty good days.
Huh. Your books are notable for strong female characters. Cate
yes.
Blanchett obviously attracted to the role in The Missing. What's that all about?
I've come from a very long, strong line of females. My grandmother, Rose Eddy, who homesteaded. My grandmother on my paternal side. Her husband developed tuberculosis in Liberal, Kansas. He left and started a cattle ranch so he wouldn't infect his family with the disease. She raised my father and two other children on her own. I come by marriage from, I'm descended from Mary Baker Eddy. So I think I have also in my genetic lineup a long line of very strong female characters. And I think they were underplayed over the decades in most books about the West. They're either very sad characters or they're kind of Joan of Arc-like. And I think there's much middle ground there to be covered.
The books have a real authentic ring to them. How do you manage that? Have you spent a lot of time in the West, or is this all just coming out of your head?
I've worked on cattle ranches. I've ridden rodeo. It's always been in my blood to be part of the countryside and farmland and cattle country.
Typical background for a vice president for corporate affairs at Fidelity Investments.
Not a prerequisite.
Now, what about the day job? You've just had another of your books optioned by Martin Scorsese, of all people. You apparently only move in the higher circles in Hollywood as far as people getting interested in your books. Quitting the day job?
No. I'm very lucky to be at Fidelity. You know, Hollywood is fun. But it's I wouldn't want to consistently count on it. Yeah. It's the old freelancer's joke of chicken today, feathers tomorrow, and so.
Well, the business world can have its ups and downs too, Tom.
That's true.
Amazing stuff, Tom Edson. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tom Edson is the author of several books, including The Last Ride, which has been made into a new film, The Missing, which is scheduled to open this week.
Stay with us. More Beatles ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The Beatles and legendary rock producer Phil Spector are both back in the news for decidedly different reasons. Spector has been charged with murder in the death of a woman in his home. The Beatles' George Harrison has been named posthumously as a new member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for his solo career. And Paul McCartney has just released Let It Be Naked, a stripped-down version of the Beatles' classic without, among other things, producer Phil Spector.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be.
Here to explain and to give us a heads up on other Beatles re-releases, including a new book of criticism, is Here Now's resident Beatles aficionado, Tim Riley. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Robin.
So, what do you think of the Let It Be Naked?
Well, I feel very mixed about it. I think that the inspiration for it and the concept of the record is actually really good, and it ties in with the original concept of the production as they started out. They wanted to spend a month filming them in rehearsal and showing songs taking shape over time. What I don't like about the Let It Be Naked project is that it's not really naked. In other words, there's a lot of overdubbing that's been added to these sessions, and there's a lot of cleaning up that's happened.
And let's remind people, the original Let It Be had a lot of Phil Spector production, and Paul McCartney has re-released this, you know, alleged naked Let It Be, because he always objected to that?
Right. First of all, Phil Spector gets a bad rap on this record. He's accused of overproducing certain tracks. And in my view, he only overproduced three tracks: Let It Be, Across the Universe, and Long and Winding Road. And the worst of these, I think, is Long and Winding Road, to which Spector added strings and a female chorus. All right? So let's listen now to the original Phil Spector Long and Winding Road, which is a very grandiose, hyped-up production.
Disappear. I've seen that road before. It always leads me here. Lead me to your door.
Very Hollywood conception of that song.
Yeah.
And now what McCartney has done is he's gone back and said, all right, let's just do it with the four Beatles playing the same song. No production with strings, no chorus. Let's hear what it sounds like with just the Beatles playing.
That road before. It always leads me here. Lead me to your door.
I think that McCartney's right on this track. I think that there's a sense of loneliness and despair that hooks up with the song's mood and lyric in a much better, more persuasive way than all of the grandiose strings.
Paul McCartney's voice, you get to hear it.
And this is a very soft, laid-back sound, a restrained sound, and it's very impressive. It's very difficult to sing that way.
Is there a place where you don't like what they've done?
Yeah, the first thing that leapt out at me, they lead with the track Get Back. And they used the same studio version of that song that they used on the original record, only they snip off the coda. And Get Back had one of these wonderful fake endings, you know, where you hear the song coming to an end and everything dies out, and then the drums come back and they give you just a little bit more. And you want a little bit more at the end of that because it's such a wonderful groove that they have hit upon there. And here on this version of Get Back, it's a simple fade out.
Where's the rest of the song?
There's something that we've been hearing that song on the radio for 30 years,
yeah.
And your ear is tuned to wanting that fake ending to turn out to be not a real ending, you know?
So what do you think, Tim? If you don't have this, do you need this in your Beatles library?
Well, I'm enough of a Beatle fan that I think you do want it because the sound is really, really wonderful. There's a lot of depth and presence to the sound that's not on the original. I mean, the digital techniques they're using now to erase erroneous sound and cracks and studio noise that's unnecessary and to enhance what's already there, you're going to hear a lot more guitar work and a lot more keyboard work from Billy Preston on this record than you've ever heard before.
But as we pointed out, you're going to be missing things. I'm thinking of Don't Let Me
Down. Well, Don't Let Me Down. There's this wonderful take of Don't Let Me Down that they did on the rooftop, where Lennon forgets the words to a verse and he sings gibberish. And it's one of his most charming moments. And they overdubbed that gibberish with a real verse so that he sings the song all the way through and it sounds like he remembers all the words. Now, I mean, I don't know about you, but I find there's something irresistible about Lennon goofing up his own words to his own song. And when they smooth that over and then try and sell it to us as something that's naked and unkempt, that's where I take objection.
Nobody ever loved me like she does. Ooh, she does. Yes, she does.
Okay, you decide. Well, in addition to the naked, there's been a lot of other Beatles stuff. Why? Is this an anniversary or something?
Well, no, I think the strategy really is that they're letting new Beatle material trickle out once a year or so. They've mm-hmm. really learned how to coordinate their marketing campaigns. And the holiday season is just an optimal season in which That's to release
right.
this stuff.
Those right angles in the stockings. You know, when you see that thing jutting out of your stocking, right. you know it's a CD
right.
or a book or something.
Right.
And, or a DVD. Right. Tell us about that.
There's two DVDs. One is the Concert for George, which took place in London last year, which has a lot of famous guest stars and a tribute to George Harrison's work. And then there's this Lennon Legend DVD, which is the DVD analog to the best-selling Lennon Legend Greatest Hits CD, and it's full of archival footage and a lot of stuff that's never been seen before, certainly not commercially, that's been put together by Yoko Ono to some of John Lennon's greatest hits. The best of that being her sort of visual soundtrack to his hit Mother. She puts all kinds of archival photographs of Lennon, his mother, his father, and as a boy to the sound of this song, and it's really quite effective.
But I never had you. I wanted you. You didn't want me.
So okay, you mentioned, Tim, that there's a new book as
yeah,
well.
This is a book that came out from Harvard University Press. It's by a new young critic named Devin McKinney called Magic Circles, The Beatles in Dream and Memory. And it has a whole bunch of insightful new readings of especially the first two movies, Hard Day's Night and Help. And they reflect outward towards the way that the Beatles were sending ripples of meaning through culture, the way they perceived themselves, the way we perceive them. And it's a very thoughtful reading of the career.
And I just thought they were fun movies. And speaking of which, the Ed Sullivan appearances have finally come out so I can look for myself.
That's right. And the fun thing about these Ed Sullivan shows, they're all from 1964, is that they're the complete shows. So you don't just get the Beatles coming out and playing. You get Ed Sullivan. You get the whole show from beginning to end with commercials. So you get a real taste of the sensibility of the culture at the time that the Beatles appeared. And the Beatles break through this facade. They break through all this sterile kind of hokey stuff that Ed Sullivan was a part of. And you can really see how dramatic their appearance was.
Well, also, you are reminded, I mean, there was some sterile and hokey, but I remember watching one, and I was reminded that they did practically all of the Broadway play Oliver. You know, there was a time when you sat down and watched Broadway musicals and the Beatles in the same show.
Right.
Tim, thank you.
Thank you.
Here now, pop and rock critic Tim Riley has a Beatles book of his own, Tell Me Why, a Beatles commentary.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
Join us again, Here and Now.
Go home.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories Here and Now.
We continue our check-in with the presidential candidates with a talk with John Edwards of North Carolina.
And we meet a murder mystery author who sets the scene of the crime in Egypt.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.